All right, welcome to another edition of Sports Inquirer Podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Portute. First, let's get to the sponsors. First of all, brought to you, as always, by the SportsInquirer.net, the premier news site for notes in the world of sports. Always some good content there. Really interested to put some mixed martial arts power rankings and finally get some NBA power rankings as well. And look forward to seeing the NFL picks up tomorrow at some point, probably tomorrow evening for this upcoming week. Also, brought to you by the StartingLineup.net, based out of Chicago, Illinois. I will actually be on the show that they have a weekly Saturday show, and I will be on there two Saturdays from now. So once we get close to that date, look forward to promoting that, and look forward to be there. Today's show is jam-packed. We're going to review UFC 167. I'm going to go over my NFL betting lines. I'm going to review each pick with you. And I think by doing that, you'll see all of my thoughts on every team in the NFL since our buys are finished. I'm going to delve into the NBA, miscellaneous notes in sports, and then finally, a triple threat edition of What's Ruffling My Feathers. It's been a while since I've been on the show. Thanks for having patience with me. Let's get to it. So last week we had UFC 167. One moment, let me just adjust my volumes here and my levels. All right, let's see if that's a little better. All right, there we go. Okay, now we're back. All right, so last week was UFC 167. A lot of controversy with the main event between George St. Pierre and Johnny Hendricks. And I'll get to the rest of the card as well. Let's start off with the GSP Hendricks fight. For those of you not familiar with mixed martial arts, there was the UFC Ultimate Fighting Championship had their welterweight championship bout, 170 pounds max limit, and the champion George St. Pierre defeated the challenger Johnny Hendricks by split decision, so he won 3-2, according to the judges. Personally, I had St. Pierre winning rounds 1 and 5, and Hendricks winning 2, 3, and 4. So personally, I actually had Hendricks winning the fight 3-2, but it was a very close fight that went to a decision. I really wasn't disappointed. I'm actually disappointed. I did not like the decision, but I was not shocked by it. It was a very close fight. Rounds could have gone either way. Personally, everyone seemed to have George St. Pierre winning round 3. I actually had Hendricks winning that round. I thought he got a good takedown and was able to control the cage in that entire third round. But in the end, a lot of people had St. Pierre. All three judges actually had it for St. Pierre. I guess the round in dispute was round 1, which I actually had for St. Pierre. But a lot of people that actually thought Hendricks won the fight had Hendricks winning that first round. And I think that just shows the nature of judging a mixed martial arts fight. Every round is subjective to what you thought was the win, whether it's getting a takedown or defending a takedown, or once you get down to the ground, what you do with it. I think submission defense could be a viable positive trait in a fight, while a lot in a round in particular, while other people will look at a submission defense as a negative because you are in a position of being of losing the fight by a action by the person that you're facing. So it's just very convoluted right there. But personally, I had Hendricks winning the fight, and let's just get to the biggest part of the fight. Probably the thing that superseded the actual action in the cage, or actual fighting. After the fight, St. Pierre spoke with Joe Rogan in the post-fight interview, talked about that he has some personal issues that he's going through, and that he may have to step away for a while to settle that. And the second part of that was President Dana White and his reaction to said statements. Personally, I thought that White's performance as a president was deplorable, and I think it showed ultimately that he is a promoter, and all he cares about is the bottom line and getting his fighters out there as much as he can to get the dollar. Now, a lot of people have been critical of White positively, and not critical of him in a positive way, but critiquing him as far as him being a voice of the fan and being someone who's brutally honest when it comes to his assessment of athletic commissions, refereeing, fighters themselves. And I think what the positives you have of White is that he does put all of his emotions and thoughts on his sleeve. It's very obvious what his opinion is, whether it's a fighter who he does speak for the fans sometimes when a fighter does not perform to his maximum potential and cheats the fans maybe out of a good performance, and he'll be the first to say that. That part's appreciated. But I think that his critique of George St. Pierre and his lack of care for him was very concerning. First, let's get to the St. Pierre part. Here you have a fighter who has done absolutely nothing wrong during his entire time in the UFC. Even White has said that St. Pierre is the easiest fighter that he's had to deal with. And that's your champion. He's the most popular fighter in the world in mixed martial arts. He's the most known guy. He's never been in trouble, as far as I know of, legally. He shows up for all his press conferences. He does his job as a fighter. And furthermore, he shows up to the cage every fight, gives his best effort, and is a good representative of the sport. And the man obviously seems like he's going through some issues. And I've seen some of the rumors of the issues that he's going through. I'm not going to dignify that with commenting because that's his personal business, and that's it. It's all speculation. But for White to say that his problems aren't as big as he thinks they are, as far as St. Pierre, is very insulting. We all go through things personally in life where we handle things in different ways. Something that you or I, you listening, may seem not to be a major issue, maybe a major issue to somebody else. And then we may take something that's very dear to us, whether it's financial, something related to our family, physical health, mental health, things like that. We may look at that as the most important aspect of our lives, and then someone from the outside may say, oh, you can get over that. And that's just very insulting to the man himself. St. Pierre owes the UFC not a darn thing as far as fighting. If St. Pierre walks away from mixed martial arts and UFC, he has more than given his due to the UFC. They have made millions and millions of dollars off of him. And St. Pierre has made money as well. St. Pierre is financially been compensated very well. You know, that's the way jobs work. You work hard, you get paid, the company makes money, and hopefully it's an amicable relationship for both parties. So I thought that White saying that St. Pierre owed Hendricks and the fans a rematch was a little disconcerting. Would I like to see a rematch? Of course I would. I think all fans want to see that fight again, especially those who thought Hendricks won that fight. I thought he won it, and I want to see them fight again. Hendricks put on a great performance, and he's being overshadowed by all of this St. Pierre and Dana White talk. So as I said, listening to that press conference and reading the quotes, the post-fight press conference and hearing that stuff, you can obviously tell that St. Pierre, and St. Pierre has referred to maybe some head trauma. That I'm not talking out of line with that. He's brought that up himself as far as losing memory of what happens in the fight and things like that. And I think all athletics, especially sports where there's a lot of head contact, we've seen it with the NFL over the past year, all of the focus on concussions and CTE and other diagnoses of brain damage and brain trauma. Mixed martial arts has to be right there as well as far as being very sensitive to that issue. And if St. Pierre feels that he needs to take care of his mental health, I should say, not mental as far as psychologically, but I guess physically of his, and I say I'm not a doctor, so getting specifics of what his brain issues may be, he has to take care of that. He has to evaluate that if that's the issue that he's saying. So I thought that White was very deplorable as far as his assessment or his reaction to his champion making statements that are maybe, you know, very sensitive, and it's a topic that you have to really be be sensitive to about. So the rest of the card, I thought Rashad Evans secured a strong win over Chael Sonnen. Both of those guys, I don't know if they're gatekeepers, but it's to the point where both of those guys are probably not going to be champions anymore as far as their respective divisions. Rashad Evans for the light heavyweight division, 205-pound class, and then Sonnen for the middleweight, 185-pound group. And Sonnen's now is going to be a coach on the Ultimate Fighter Brazil against Wanderlei Silva. That's going to cause a lot of fireworks and a lot of drama. That's going to be fun for the fans viewing the show. And it should be an interesting fight itself. I think both guys are kind of in the same place in their career. Probably fight at a catch weight, 195, or maybe 185. We'll see if Silva can get down that to that weight. But that's going to happen there. My favorite part of the entire card was the rise of Robbie Lawler, putting an end to the Rory McDonald hype train. For old school MMA fans like myself, seeing a guy like Lawler, whose first pro fight was when McDonald was 11 years old, and McDonald is 24 years old, so we'll get, as far as McDonald goes, young guy, he's going to be okay. I think this fight may be good for him, shows him that he needs to be more aggressive in the cage, as far as his techniques go, and Lawler just put a beating on him, and that was something that McDonald, I think, can use in the future. And he's going to be a future champion if he stays healthy and nothing bizarre happens. I think he's one of those guys where you see where John Jones and Cain Velasquez, when those guys were coming up at their ages, you kind of realize, okay, he's going to be a champion at some point if all works out for him. So McDonald will be a UFC champion someday. But it's funny seeing Lawler, fun seeing him fighting in the UFC. I've seen the man fight in King of the Cage, IFC, remember International Fighting Championship, that team concept of mixed martial arts. He was in that. Icon, he fought in Hawaii for a little while. He was fought in Elite XC, even went over to Hawaii in Icon. And I guess more fans who have gone into mixed martial arts the past 4 or 5 years have seen him in Strikeforce. He is an OG of the game, and it seemed like he was a throw-in in a Strikeforce deal when Zuffa acquired that promotion. It seemed like they just took Lawler, okay, we'll take him in, he'll be a filler for some of our fight cards. But he has 3 consecutive wins over Josh Koscheck, who got knocked out himself in a nasty, Woodley took it to him as well, but Lawler's beating Koscheck, Bobby Volkler, and now McDonald. And once again, in a division that may need some viable contenders, the 170-pound class, the welterweight division, Robbie Lawler may be a major contender for that. And once the St. Pierre situation gets settled in, as far as if when he fights again or whatever, Lawler may be a guy that you have to consider getting a title shot. And last thing, as far as the UFC goes, and with Dana White and Zuffa and George St. Pierre, now I'll get off of him. We'll move on to NFL topics. If White wants to strip St. Pierre of the belt, if he doesn't want to compete, I actually understand that. If he took that side of the angle, it's well within a promotion's right that if a fighter refuses to participate in their promotion and in the fight, and whether it's contract issue or the fighter doesn't like the opponent that's been chosen as the number one contender for the belt, if a promotion feels that they need to strip the champion of the belt and relinquish that title, I can understand that. And that may end up what's happening with St. Pierre. I doubt it. I think cooler heads will prevail, and you'll see St. Pierre back in the ring for financial reasons. And I think he wants to compete as a fighter. But if the UFC wants to do that, I have no problems with that. So I just want to get that last point in there. Send your thoughts to me on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word, or at thesportsinquirer@gmail.com. Or as usual, go to sportsinquirer.net, thesportsinquirer.net. Got to get the in there. And from there, you can leave some comments in there as well. We're going to take a short break, and when I come back, I'm going to go over the upcoming week of the National Football League. welcome back to the show. Let's get to some NFL betting lines. This upcoming week in the NFL season, everyone's bye week has come and gone. Playoff pictures are starting to be formed. Teams that are doing well are starting to see if they can win divisions. Teams not doing so well, really increasing their draft scouting for the draft coming up next year. Let's get to New Orleans at Atlanta. The Saints are favored by 8.5. Complete shutdown by the Falcons overall. Last week was a bad loss to the Bucks in Tampa, and you're really starting to see some major struggles from the team overall. This Thursday night game is going to be tomorrow night or tonight for those of you listening to the show on Thursday. I think you're going to see the Saints really put a number on the Falcons. Double-digit win by New Orleans. So take the Saints plus or minus 8.5 at home against Atlanta. Detroit at home minus 9 against those same Buccaneers that beat up on Tampa last week. Detroit making some positive moves right up there at the top of the NFC North division. I think you're going to end up seeing they're minus 9, so they're favored by 9 points over the Bucs. I think that the Lions at home are going to put up a double-digit win over the Bucks, who have actually looked more motivated. Shiano, I don't know if he's going to still last there for next season, but that team's improved. Mike Glennon is looking respectable as a starting quarterback in that spot. But I think on the road against a hot Lions team, especially with Calvin Johnson performing at the rate that he is and Reggie Bush incorporating himself into the offense, and maybe the best front four in the NFL, so at least the best tackles between Nick Fairley and Ndamukong Suh, the way they're playing for the Lions, I'm going to take the home team, minus 9. Houston, minus 10 at home against Jacksonville. Texans are a complete mess right now. You have Matt Schaub and Andre Johnson arguing on the sideline. Obviously, Gary Kubiak dealing with his health issues, not being on the sidelines as head coach for the Texans. Jacksonville, they're the Jags. They've been awful all season. I'm actually going to take Jacksonville to cover this game. I think the Texans still win it, but we've actually seen Jacksonville play respectable. They played okay against Indy. They held a good lead at Seattle. So the Jaguars, while they are the worst team in the NFL by a pretty good distance, they play well on the road at times. So I'm going to take Jacksonville plus 10 to cover that game. Green Bay minus 5 at Minnesota at home against Minnesota. Wow. Aaron Rodgers is really proving his MVP candidacy by being out. Ever since he got injured in his collarbone, the Bucs have looked very pedestrian over their past two games. Minnesota, another complete mess as well. The quarterback play between Matt Castle and Christian Ponder has been terrible. I guess I'll take the home team minus the 5 and just go with the Packers just because they're home. And I think their offense will do just enough to get past the Vikings. Kansas City minus 5 at home against San Diego. Last week, Kansas City went to Denver. Didn't win, but I thought looked respectable. They had some moments where they could have taken advantage of some opportunities. Had their first loss of the season. San Diego lost a bad game on the road at Miami, and now they have to go back on the road to face a Kansas City squad, which has one of the best home field advantages in all of the NFL. I think Kansas City is still an excellent team, still a double-digit win team. That's going to compete with Denver all the way to the end of the season, but to the AFC West title. Kansas City wins that game by at least 10 points pretty easily. Sneaky game coming up here. Carolina on the road is minus 4, 4-point favorite on the road at Miami. Obviously, Miami with a solid win at home against the Chargers, dealing with all distractions of the Richie Incognito, Jonathan Martin issues, but they finally got off a little losing streak that they had and won. Carolina, obviously maybe one of the bigger regular season wins in franchise history. You got to remember the Panthers actually went to the Super Bowl several years ago and lost to the Patriots. So they've had bigger wins in their franchise as far as postseason goes. But for regular season and where the Panthers have been the past 3, 4, 5 years, that was a very big win for them. The Panthers' defense is very strong. Cam Newton maybe throwing his hat. If it wasn't for the Peyton Manning offensive record-shattering season that he's having, Cam Newton may be your MVP of the entire NFL. There's still about 40% of the season to go, and Cam might make his presence felt in that MVP vote. But I think them going to Miami and maybe the best defense in the NFL with the Panthers, statistically they're right up there with Seattle and a few other teams. I'm going to take Carolina to win on the road by more than 4 points at Miami. Cleveland at home, -2 favorite over Pittsburgh. I'll just take the Browns, their home. Browns looked okay again. They had held a lead against Cincinnati last week on the road, just couldn't hold it. I think going home, Pittsburgh just reeling with injuries and otherwise, I'll take the Browns. St. Louis -1 against Chicago. If Jay Cutler's not on the field, that's going to be a major issue for the Bears. And St. Louis, while having struggles of their own, especially with Clemens starting at quarterback and outside of Tavon Austin, not much offensive threats for the Rams, they're a feisty team at home. I'm going to take the Rams -1 to win that contest, just to the factor of being at home. And I think Tavon Austin is going to be a major factor for the Rams. Baltimore -3.5 at home against the Jets. I can't trust Geno Smith on the road under any circumstances. If Matt Sims has to make an appearance as well, that's even worse for the Jets. And I think Rex Ryan has done the best he could with this roster. So it's not a critique on him necessarily. But when you have a rookie quarterback out there, it's very, very tough to achieve success in the NFL. We've been spoiled by seeing like Russell Wilson and Andrew Luck and even Robert Griffin III last year have success in their first seasons. That's very, very rare. And you're starting to see that with Geno Smith and the realities of that. So I still think Baltimore wins that game pretty easily. Oakland at home -1 against Tennessee. Once again, another toss-up game. I guess Terrell Pryor is not going to play this week as of the recording of this podcast. In the end, I'll take the Raiders to win at home. Arizona at home -2 versus Indianapolis. Cardinals are a frisky team as well. Carson Palmer is starting to produce well offensively. Another solid defense, especially in the back end and that secondary between Tyrann Mathieu and Patrick Peterson. I'm going to take the Cards at home to win that contest against Indianapolis and maybe the upset of the week. Indianapolis is still a very strong team. Andrew Luck has had an outstanding season. But I'm going to take the Cards to win that one at home. Giants at home -2, 2-point favorite over Dallas. Giants started off 0-6 and now won their last four. I think only a game out of first place. I think they continue the momentum and beat the Cowboys, who are such a Jekyll and Hyde team. You don't know what to expect with that squad. I'm going to take the Giants to win -2. And if Eli Manning can avoid throwing interceptions, I think the Giants have a chance to possibly win the division. Even though I think ultimately Philadelphia is going to win that division. Denver -2.5 on the road on Sunday night at New England. Obviously, we saw what happened with New England. Hung in there towards the very end. Controversial non-pass interference call at the end that may have given the Patriots an opportunity to win the game. And speaking of that as well, no sympathy at all for the Patriots as far as, yes, because of Spygate and Belichick and just the way they act from an emotional level. But from a rational NFL analyst perspective, I didn't think that was an interference call. I know a lot of people are whining, complaining, like, oh, that was bad. He just stood in the way of Gronkowski from coming back to the ball. That's just gamesmanship. He didn't grab him. He didn't hold him. He just stood in front of him. And you can say, oh, he was impeding him from getting to that area of the field. That ball was underthrown. It was not a catchable ball for him. And if they called pass interference, I guess I could have understood that a little bit. But personally, I didn't think that was an interference call. I thought that was a good call by the officials. And furthermore, that game did not come down to one play. That game came down to the Patriots not being able to contain Cam Newton in the pocket and allowing him to make some big completions to Steve Smith. That's why the Patriots lost that game. And then last game of the week is going to be San Francisco on Monday night on the road. 5-point favorite over the Washington Redskins. That's another tricky game, but I'm going to take San Francisco minus the 5. Robert Griffin III is looking better. He's starting to get there as far as his knee and his improvements on the field. I still think he rushed coming back, and you're starting to see that now that he's starting to play a little bit better. But I think San Francisco, this is the game where they realize they have to start winning ugly. I mean, Kaepernick is a strong quarterback and someone who does great things with his arms. But for San Francisco to win, they have to rely on their physical defense and a rushing attack. And this is one of those games where I think you see Frank Gore, and the rest of the running backs get 30 to 40 carries. Kaepernick as well, him running. I think you see the 49ers run it 30 to 40 times, control the clock, and grind out a 7-point win over a Redskins squad that is struggling itself. So those are my NFL thoughts. You know where to hit me up with some commentary on that. We're going to take another break, and when we come back, I'm going to talk about the National Basketball Association here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. Welcome back to the podcast. E. Marcel Portut, as always. I'm going to delve into the NBA. Teams have played about 10 to 15 games already and starting to see the good teams from the not-so-good teams and everything in between. First thought, not one team in the Atlantic Division has a winning record. The Knicks, the Nets, the Sixers, Celtics, and the Raptors are all under 500 and struggling in all of their own various ways. And we'll get to each of them at some point through my commentary. But for a division that has the Celtics, 76ers, Knicks, teams that have had their moments throughout the history of being top flight franchises in all of the NBA, even the Nets have had their they've had a few finals appearances. Let's see, the Northeast corridor of the NBA, really a media backbone as far as coverage, struggles so much, it's extremely surprising overall. Chicago's a sneaky 6-3 right now. Indiana is legit 9-1. And I think my point was kind of killed when I was watching SportsCenter in the gym today and seeing Stephen A. Smith on ESPN doing a full interview with the starting lineup for the Pacers and Frank Vogel, the head coach. I was going to play the card of they're the Pacers. No one knows about them. They're getting a lack of respect. They got about a good 5 to 7 minute feature on SportsCenter today. I think fans are starting to realize that the best team that's to beat Miami as far as the Eastern Conference goes, maybe in the entire NBA, is going to come from the Pacers. Especially with Lance Stephenson making his contributions, being a two-way player, and Paul George slowly etching himself or putting himself as far as position of maybe the best forwards in the league. Honestly, if you look at forwards, it's LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Kevin Love, and after that, it might be Paul George as far as a guy who's the slasher, shooting guard, small forward. He's a special talent. And if the Pacers get those two things continued, they can definitely beat the Heat, who right now are cruising or just coasting with a 7-3 record. Maybe it's because of apathy, because they've won the last two titles, and there's only so many ways you can say that LeBron James is the best player in the NBA. But it's been pretty quiet on the Miami front as far as coverage goes of them. Wade looks like he's actually he's pacing himself, staying healthy. And that's really what it comes down to in the end for Miami. James is going to do his thing. Bosch makes his contributions. The rest of the Heat players, they kind of know their roles. You can pretty much jot down within a few points what you're going to get from them. If Wade stays healthy and can stay upright the entire season, especially in the playoffs, Miami has a very good chance to three-peat. If he doesn't, then Indiana and Chicago are going to beat them in the playoffs. And speaking of the Bulls, I like all of the commentary of Chicago and Derrick Rose is off to a bad start and what's wrong with the Bulls. Chicago is only 6-3 and Rose is not even playing at 80 to 90% of his talent right now. It's going to take him time to come back from that major knee surgery, because not only does he have to deal with the knee surgery, he hasn't played in an entire year. He's playing right now. You don't just come into the NBA, even as someone talented as Rose, and implement yourself back into being a 26-8 guy like he was. That's going to take time, but once he figures it out, they're going to be a force. I'm surprised by Atlanta being 6-4, pleasantly surprised. Being here in Hawk Country, I want to see Atlanta do well because it's good for the city and it's positive vibes. Jeff Teague has really stepped his game up in the point guard position. I think not having Josh Smith was the best thing for his career as far as having control of the ball and the flow of the offense. It's his baby now. It's not Josh Smith to take 20-foot jumpers and to just hold on to the ball. It's Teague's game right now. It's Teague's team to run. And I think he's done a solid job with that overall. Probably surprising the entire NBA, though, has been the Portland Trailblazers, who are 9-1 right now. Their biggest factor is they're 6th in the NBA in points per game and 16th in points allowed per contest. Yes, they've had a weak schedule. They really haven't faced any top teams. But with Damian Lillard playing his game in front and LaMarcus Aldridge playing his post-up game and his outside shooting and Nicholas Batum making his contributions, Robin Lopez giving them some solid minutes as well as far as post-play. Portland, I didn't have them as a playoff team, but I think they can elevate themselves to maybe a 5 or 6 seed and become a very dangerous opponent for one of the teams in the Western Conference in the playoffs. We're going to know a lot more about Portland because they host Chicago on Thursday, tomorrow night, and then travel to Golden State on Friday. If they sweep those two teams, then I'll give the mantle of best team in the NBA right now, as far as the regular season goes. I'm really looking forward to coming home and watching that Chicago game and also watching that Golden State contest. I've gone through all of these NBA teams and analysis and commentary and haven't even mentioned the San Antonio Spurs, who quietly are 9-1. They may be the least talked about 9 wins out of 10 games to start a season franchise in history. We're going to talk about the Rockets and their struggles with Dwight Howard and talk about all the Eastern Conference teams and even Portland. San Antonio has really mastered mastered the process of managing your regular season. Now, 9-1 is probably a little bit better than they expected just because of the players that they sit and the way they rotate and minutes, things like that. But it just shows that that system is so efficient and effective in the regular season. And especially when you have Kawhi Leonard, who has really picked up the slack for Ginobili's and Duncan's maybe slip-off or regression as players, understandable with their age and the amount of minutes that they played in their careers. When you have a guy like Leonard who can give you an inside-outside presence, and Parker continuing to stake his claim as the best point guard in the NBA, that's where you get a Spurs team that's 9-1 and doing as well as they have. As far as Houston goes, defense is going to be their biggest issue. They're going to score points. Harden is going to get his buckets. Dwight Howard, a lot of analysis of his lack of post play, you know, which is legitimate. And maybe next podcast I'll delve a little bit more specifically into what I've seen from their games as far as his post-up skills. But they're still 7-4. They're trying to incorporate a new guy into their rotation. They went from a team that shot, I think, the most threes in NBA history, or maybe averaged the most per game, or right up there, to incorporating the best center in the NBA, a post player. And they've had only one offseason to adjust to that. It's going to take time to find that balance. And once they do, they're going to be a lethal and dangerous team. And I still think they're going to make the NBA Finals as far as the Western Conference goes. And then finally, respect to some of the lower talented or weaker talented teams for not participating in tanking. Phoenix is 5-4. Philly is 5-7. Boston has been respectable at 4-7. And even Utah at 1-11. And I have respect for them too. And I'll get to each for reasons for that. The whole process of tanking and intentionally losing games to gain draft picks, I don't think that's the method that you go with if you're an NBA franchise. I think what you do is that you clear out your roster financially of players that you know are not going to be in your long-term future. And that's usually veterans who make a significant amount of money. What those teams have done is cleared out all of those veterans and have given chances to younger guys. In Phoenix, you're starting to see the Morris twins and Eric Bledsoe get a lot of minutes. Philadelphia, Evan Turner's playing. Michael Carter-Williams, Spencer Hawes, he's a veteran as far as age goes, but you're giving all of them chances to play. Boston gone with a major youth movement, obviously getting rid of Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce and Ray Allen from the year before. They've completely gone with a younger squad. And Utah letting Al Jefferson walk away, giving Enes Kanter and Derek Favors some run, and Trey Burke, and letting those guys get on the court and perform. Now, obviously, Utah doesn't want to be 1-11. That's embarrassing. And Ty Corbin probably won't have his job by the time I do my next podcast at the rate that we're going. But if you're going to lose, you may as well lose young. And they're evaluating their talent and seeing where they are. And they're all going to be lottery teams, and they're all going to struggle. And it's even better if you end up with maybe the most stacked top 5 or 6 draft class in history, with Jabari Parker and Randall and Wiggins from Kansas and Gordon out of Arizona, Marcus Smart, who had a career high last night for Oklahoma State against Memphis. If you get one of those guys, it's even better for your franchise, because you've had a group of young guys who have gained experience throughout a season that may have not been successful as far as wins and losses, but you get to evaluate and see what they can do for you. So respect to those teams for approaching it the right way as far as rebuilding a franchise. All right, we're going to take one last break, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into some topics outside of the world of sports here on the podcast. Back to the Sports Inquirer podcast, host E. Marcel Portoot. No college football or NHL news on this show. We already had a jam-packed show, and we'll get to those episodes, or those items next week for the show. But very good season for me personally. Central Florida, the nephew, is putting in major work for the Knights, right now a top 15 team in the nation. doing really well, going for that AAC championship. Have a big game tomorrow night, or tonight, or Thursday against Rutgers. Going to have a go to a viewing party for that. Really hyped about that. My Commodores, Vanderbilt, 6 wins, bowl eligible for the 3rd consecutive season for the first time ever. I was personally, when I was back at Vanderbilt in the late 90s, early 2000s, after my first year, I thought to myself, if they actually went to a bowl game, the first one, I would be there. And sure enough, they played in the Music City Bowl against Boston College and won that game. And it was in Nashville, a very emotional, fun moment for me. I didn't think they would be to the point where they were consistently being a bowl eligible team. Now, for a lot of you fans out there and of your college football teams, being a 6-7 win team may be disappointing. But for someone who actually has seen the low depths of Vanderbilt football, the fact that they may be an 8-win team, and I'm slightly disappointed, and I think they could have had 9 wins or maybe even more. Great job by Coach Franklin and all his staff and everything that they've done there. Hopefully we can keep them. Texas is going to probably be open. USC is going to be an open position. And probably some other school that I'm not even thinking of. But good times in college football. NHL, not too much on that front. We'll get to some NHL. I have a pretty clear weekend to watch some ice hockey, so I'm hyped about that. What I'm not hyped about was the ending of Eastbound and Down. Saw the finale Sunday night. My boy Kenny Powers hung it up. And it's been a few days. Spoiler alert, whatever. He ends up moving to New Mexico with April and the kids. And really fun show. Really quirky show. Didn't expect much out of it when it first came out. I give all sports shows a chance just because I'm a sports fan. But when you get, you know, anything involving sports, you worry about is going to be accurate. What's the game? How are they going to look at good playing the game as far as on the field and things like that? Eastbound and Down, they picked a really good subject, a relief pitcher that you didn't have to see pitch much, and looked at him outside of that. I don't even think they mentioned he threw one baseball this entire last 4th season of Eastbound and Down. He's at least when he went to Mexico and tried to revamp his career, and then played in the Carolina League. You saw him out there throwing. He didn't do any throwing this season at all. It was definitely a different tone with the show, and sad to see it go, but I think it ended on a proper note. I think they got all the jokes you can out of that. Really good week for me, though, as far as seeing some things in Atlanta. Went to the Fern Theater. Well, actually, the theater's called Seven Stages. It's in Little Five Points here in Atlanta. But the company that put this show together is called the Fern Theater. And I saw an all-female production of Macbeth. My English teacher back in at Browning, he'd be very proud of me for going to see a Macbeth show on a Sunday afternoon instead of watching the NFL. But anyway, really good production by it. It was kind of confusing because I've seen Macbeth several times. I read it. I think we've all read it in high school or college. But I wasn't as familiar with the plot as I should have been. I really should have cliff notes it or Wikipedia'd it just to remind myself, like, oh, Macbeth did this and Lady Macbeth did all this stuff. But by the end of it, I kind of had it together. Even though it was confusing because it was a cast of about 7 women and they played multiple characters, so you kind of had to remember, oh, that's Macduff, that's Lady Macduff, okay, that's, you know, Banquo and all that stuff. So it was a little bit confusing as far as that goes, but I thought it was a really well-done production and really good angle of seeing women in masculine positions. And if you're familiar with with English theater, of how it used to be back in the days of Shakespeare, a lot of the female characters we played by males, just because of the rules of how things went in England at that time. So watching Romeo and Juliet, you may have seen a male Juliet, things like that. So I thought it was good to have a little role reversal of that and seeing a female Macbeth. So I thought that was really fun. I wanted to see the Eric Andre show. If you're a fan of Adult Swim like I am, He actually did a show last night in Atlanta, and I was not able to attend it. But I've been catching up on my Eric Andre. I've been delving heavy into his shows, and Hannibal Buress was one of my favorite young stand-up comedians out there. So I did not attend that, so I was kind of disappointed not being able to go to that show. I'm going to attend a nice black cinema festival at Emory this weekend, probably Sunday night, head down there. Point is, I'm really trying to embrace the city. I have a love-hate relationship with Atlanta. Some good parts to it, not so good parts to it. Where I'm situated is a little bit outside the city, so I'm not able to head downtown or even into Midtown and some other parts as much as I like. But I'm making a concerted effort to do more of that and really enjoying my time as far as independence and trying to see some things while I am in the city. And as I said, I'm going to be in Chicago in 2 weeks. Looking forward to that. I need to start planning and organized. I have some things that I'm trying to delve into, but if you are a resident of the city or have been there and visited there, send me an email or hit me up on Twitter or Facebook and tell me what I should check out. So those are what I've been doing over the past week or two since I last spoke with you. Finally, we're going to get to what's ruffling my feathers. Show open, I talked about things that were, as far as ruffling my feathers, would be a triple threat. But looking at it, it really delves into one, or funnels into one concept. Invasion of private space. Now, when I was younger, I was a big violator of invading a private space. If I was walking next to you, we were talking, I'd be right up to you. Kind of like the close talker that Judge Reinhold played on Seinfeld, where if we're having a conversation, I pretty much was, our noses could have touched at times. But I learned quickly over time that you have to respect people and the distance that you have with them. I've had my personal space violated several times since we last spoke. My first pet peeve, or what ruffled my feathers, was tailgating. I was driving home from work, going about 35 in a 35 zone, literally on the block away from where I live. And this gentleman or woman, I don't know, it was dark, it was nighttime, proceeded to drive right up on my bumper while I was heading home. I was going the speed limit. It's a one-lane highway or one-lane street. If I was going 20, I can understand that. And we all catch ourselves doing that sometimes, where maybe we're spacing out. Not necessarily spacing out, but we're driving. Maybe the speed limit changes on us from 25 to 35. Yet we're still going a little slow. When that happens, you realize, okay, I can speed up a little bit and increase my gas. But I was going the speed limit. And if you're going the speed limit, you have no reason to bump up on me. So you know what I did? I pulled the move I learned at a very early age when I was driving. I slowed down even more. If you're going to tailgate me for going 35 at the speed limit, I'm going to go 25 right now. And I'm going to crawl. And the beauty of it was that there was no one else behind him. Now, I feel bad pulling that move if there's someone behind the person that's tailgating me, because they actually lose a little bit during the process. But there was no one else behind that driver behind me. I must have crept at 20 to 25 miles an hour for a good 30 to 45 seconds. I wish I could have done it much longer, but unfortunately I had to turn into the street of where I live. And the minute I went into that turn lane, he sped off honking at me. And I gave the biggest honk back, and it was a great feeling. Hopefully that person learned a lesson not to violate my space when I'm following the rules. Once again, another violation of my personal space was the gym. So people keep walking in front of me while I'm lifting. It's one thing if you're just standing there and I come into your area and I start lifting and then you walk away. I understand that. I can respect that. But if you see me trying to bench or trying to curl all of this weight and you're just walking in front of me, that's disrespectful. And actually, there's a third one of example of invasion of personal space. And this really goes out to the men out there listening to the show. Why is it that two times in the past 3 days, I'm at a urinal taking care of business, and a gentleman goes to the next urinal and starts talking to me? That is the worst time to talk to another man, is when they're in the middle of their business in the bathroom. And you don't want to say anything and be rude, you just give a nod like, yeah, I know, okay. But that's very disrespectful to do that to another man. I'm going to steal a phrase, that's a violation of guy code. If MTV wants to sue me, whatever. But that's something you definitely do not do to another person or another man. I don't know if there's an equivalent for women as far as that goes. I'm pretty sure there is. But if I'm standing at the urinal area and someone just comes up to you and takes care of their business and starts talking about the... One person talked about the weather. Why am I thinking about the weather when I'm in the bathroom? I don't care that it's been cold the past few days. That makes no sense. And then another one was talking about something like sports related. I don't remember what the other one. I blacked out on the other one. I just tried to ignore completely what he was talking about. But two times in the past 3 days, do I look that talkative? Or do I get off that vibe like, okay, I want to have a nice conversation with you? No. Save that for outside of the bathroom. Or maybe if we're in the same aisle in the store, like, you can say something. But not when I'm in there in the bathroom doing business. So, what's ruffled my feathers over the past 2 weeks has been an invasion of my private space. And I know all of you can relate to that situation as well. Once again, thank you for listening to the show. It's been fun. We'll have a show probably next week, a pre-Thanksgiving episode. And from there, just continue to go to sportsinquirer.net for some more content. Obviously, I'm on Twitter every single day under Sports Inquirer, all one word. And send me an email as well at sportsinquirer@gmail.com. So until then, have an excellent night. Be safe out there. And if I don't hear from you before then, have a happy holiday season starting off with Thanksgiving.